And our first artist is in the studio.
Is one we prepared
just
earlier. Kate Gorringe-Smith, thank you so much for coming in.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me today.
Thank you for not just only coming in, but also providing such a beautiful piece of work. And it is called A Constellation of Curlews. And I am going to ask you what that is very, very soon. But let's start with a little bit of your background first. When did the art bug, you know, get you? Were you ensnared?
I've always drawn pictures ever since ever. My mum has always made art as well. She used to do classes. She started doing oil painting and watercolouring, very much the 1970s housewife. You know, she did the craft lessons and then got drawn into actually sort of doing more arty art, I suppose you'd say. So there was always stuff around the house. And
because it's interesting you mentioned that, because the 70s was very arty.
Yes.
For the mums and housewives. Wasn't it? You know, like a really... And why did it fall away? I suppose the women went out into the workforce more.
But I also think it became more organised. I think people stopped taking the housewives for granted so much, and there were more mothers groups and things like that, which I don't think necessarily occurred then. Like, yep. Nowadays when you have a baby you get put into a group automatically.
And
so I guess it was probably just also a way to reach out into the community and meet more people.
And I think the world became more interested in art, didn't it? Because we went through the 50s where it was the, you know, like the 10 years after the war, and then the 60s, well, the, you know, like so much happened, change.
Yeah.
And then the 70s became a little bit more, hold on, there's all this really interesting art that's going on, you know. Like all that, what is that? And it's huge again right this very moment, like a lot of 70s stuff is, where you knot rope and...
Crochet and macrame.
Macrame.
Yes, yeah,
Mumsy
Macrame, the potholder.
Yep, so did my mother.
Yeah, and the raffia dolls.
She didn't go that far. Yeah.
And the dolly for the toilet rolls, I think was very...
Yes. Although, no, that was more the grandmother's art.
Yeah, okay,
you know, like where this other stuff was, because the hippies were, you know, like, you know, it was more sort of the alternative lifestyle.
Yeah,
that
was filtering down then, I think, into the general sort of just the middle classes too.
Absolutely.
Yeah. An interesting time.
It was. Yeah. And in a way, continue with your story.
So I was always drawing and painting, and then it was when I was in HSC in those days, and the school I was at, we were offered printmaking, and that was what really totally blew my mind. We were donated an etching press to the school, and it just happened to be the etching press owned by Fred Williams.
Oh, my God.
Who recently passed away, and his daughters were at the school, so his widow donated his press to the school.
Yep.
And the fact that, it was his press, and also it was a big press, like the bed would have been a couple of metres by, you know, 1.2 metres. So it was a big piece of sort of, it looked like Industrial Revolution, furniture or machinery.
Most other schools wouldn't, or hardly any other school would have had anything
really
like that.
Yeah.
And because all it was just, you know, like what I did was lino cutting.
Exactly.
And then, you know, like, and you,
yeah,
you know, it was
which almost
basic.
Always led to near fatal injuries as well, didn't
oh,
it?
Yes. All going home with paint all over me as well.
And the lino in those days was just lino, basically. So it was so hard to cut.
Yep.
Yeah, so I hated lino for a long, long time. And till it was too hard for me to do etching. So I started off doing etchings, and I stopped doing that for a while because I ended up doing an arts degree at Melbourne Uni. But I sort of kept that. It was niggling at me wanting to go back to printmaking. It has a way of doing that because it's a technique and a process, and there's no other way you can really experience it unless you're doing it. Like, you can do a drawing or you can do a painting, but the whole process involved in printmaking is just very sort of meditative and quite a long drawn out thing to do.
Well, and also because the layers you can produce, isn't it? Which makes it very interesting, because most other paintings, yes, you can add paint for different layers, but this is you printing layer upon layer, aren't you?
Sometimes. I mean, the print I brought in is just one lino card.
Is it?
Yeah, just in black.
Oh, see, I would have...
on paper.
As a novice, I thought it was probably four or five.
Oh, sadly, no. I'd say it is, but it's not. But yeah, you certainly can build up layers, and you can use different techniques on each layer. It's really, once you get going, you can go anywhere you like with it. But and then I studied printmaking at RMIT later on, at the same time as I was working for BirdLife, which is where my love for birds, because a lot of my work involves birds.
And did you print on fabric or anything along the way, or you didn't go down that track?
Not really, no. I didn't. The only thing
actually
I haven't
learned. You did the
Marimekko?
No.
And in fact, I've never done silk screen printing.
Right.
That's the one thing haven't even tried. I'd love to, but when I was at RMIT, I remember one of the teachers saying, well, I'm not going to teach you that because it's too toxic.
Oh.
So, I know. But okay. Now it's not at all.
Right.
Like, it's very, very safe.
Well, I think back in that, you know, like, back in the, quite a few years ago as well, you know, like the paints would have been very toxic.
I think it's
like thousands of years ago. Yeah, I can't believe that how old they ended up. A lot of them lived because the fumes and all that would have been pretty bad.
I know. And even now, you have to be really, really careful. And there's a big movement for non-toxic printmaking, particularly in etching, because you're using the acids to bite metal,
right?
And you have to have a really well ventilated space. And there are less toxic ways of doing it now, but a lot of it is just being really careful and like. Using terps to clean up is
terrible. Is it? Right.
Yeah, terrible for you. So
yeah. Yeah, go on. So what happened next after RMIT?
Well, after RMIT, well, then I got married and had children and then everything stops. And you just
Boy, how many times have we heard that story? We've heard that story so many times.
Yes.
But the wonderful thing, obviously, you continued.
Yeah, then you then, hopefully, once they're sort of old enough and you have a few hours to string together, then if you're lucky, you get to go back to it. And I was quite lucky. And I found a group of women and we got an exhibition together, and that was in about 2010, I think, or 2009. And it sort of, then it went from there, because I think once you break through a couple of those fear boundaries of putting together an exhibition and putting stuff in the public arena, you soon forget that fear and you try and tackle the next fear of, you know, a better gallery or more people or, you know, so, yeah.
What were some of the mental barriers at that time for you?
I think it's... Well, exhibiting is always quite frightening because you don't know. You know, you've created this thing and obviously you're hoping people are going to like it as much as you do. But there's no guarantee of that at all. And I think, and there's sort of stages, because the first couple of shows you have, all your friends and family come and you sell heaps and you think, oh, this is amazing, I really am good. And then once you've sort of broken through that and everybody in your family owns one of your pieces of work, that's when it gets trickier, because then people who don't know you have to start buying your work.
And how hard is that to break into... you know, like finding an audience for your work?
I'm still working that out. But, and then you have to start being a bit more like a business, and if you're lucky, you get a gallery to represent you, and that helps a lot. And social media is a huge thing, and setting up your own website, I think, and then just putting yourself out as much as you can wherever the opportunities arise, and you tend to say yes to everything.
Yeah. And are you getting, you know, like, are you selling much? Are you, you know, like, is
on
it working for you?
Yeah, I don't. It's certainly not a living.
Yep.
For me.
We hear that a lot with artists, yes.
It's bits and pieces, but I think, well, if you can afford to do it without necessarily making it your living, then it's a huge privilege and you're very lucky, because you can pursue the avenues that you love. I think other people then, that might be when they need to turn it into a business and do tea towels or cards or, you know, become designers and get it out there as more of a product. If you don't have to follow that route, then you can keep testing the water. And I think then that's just... if you try and maintain your own integrity and just try and make work that you love and hope that people will also love it. And occasionally, and you know, and then sometimes you find people that do and you go, oh my God. So.
Yeah, brilliant. You're on Joy 94.9, Sunday Arts Magazine.
And we are talking with Kate Gorringe-Smith and wonderfully donated a piece of work for our art auction. We'll get into more of that. But we were talking about her upbringing with her very artistic mother. And we've got a message in from Melina, a friend of the show.
Oh, hello.
I love Melina. And Melina says, my mother is a middle-class hippie child just like Justin Trudeau. You become open-minded and have empathy in your heart along with good-looking offspring. And Melina is enjoying the show, which is always a good thing.
Excellent.
Now, Kate, I did mention the artwork that you've very, very kindly donated. So tell us just a little bit more about a constellation of curlews.
So my artwork, since I sort of started, I guess, working as an artist close to full-time or as close as I can manage, is often about migratory shorebirds. Of course.
Why not?
Of course.
So where did the interest come from?
As I mentioned briefly, years ago in the 90s, I worked for 6 years for BirdLife Australia, but back then it was called the Royal Australasian Ornithologists Union.
Gosh.
As I'm sure you would know. And it was a great place to work, lots and lots of passionate people. And the main thrust of it, well, apart from saving all the birds, is birds are bioindicators. So when your bird life starts to drop, your habitat's getting stuffed. Mm-hmm. So keep the birds happy, everybody stays happy. Anyway, so we, from 2006, 7 and 8, my family and I lived in England for a while because of my husband's work. And when we came back, it coincided with the death of my father, which was very sad. And it also coincided with when I had more time, all my children were finally at school, so I had more time to make art. So I was looking, and it was a very hard year that year we came back. And it made me realise, like I said, you know, we're middle class. It was for my husband's work. We had a house to come back to. It made me think, God, if it's hard for me, how hard must it be for people who have nothing? You know, all the people in the world who are displaced. And so I was looking for a metaphor I could use in my art to capture that restlessness and longing. And also talking to my mother, who she came from England the year I was born, and with Dad gone, she was suddenly very unrooted. And migratory shorebirds, they're small brown birds. They live on the tidal edge of the coast. They don't have webbed feet, so they can't swim in the water. So they chase the tide out. They eat on the mud flats or the shores while the tide's out. As the tide comes in, they have to run back in again. And the remarkable thing about them, we have about 36 species that spend the winter, the summer here in Australia, but every single year they migrate up the coast of Asia to Alaska and Siberia, where they breed.
Oh my God.
And then they come back again every year of their adult lives. Some of these birds weigh no more than 2 50-cent pieces or a box of matches. They are tiny.
It's incredible,
birds.
Isn't it?
They are incredible. And the thing is, not many people know about them.
No.
Every time I tell people, they go, really? So it caught nicely that feeling that I find, you know, from my talking to my mum particularly, like, she never stopped thinking of England as home, but here is home too. This is where she had her kids. Her mum came out and lived with us. She can't go back to live. She's stuck, you know, but it's still home. So you're always divided, and everybody just about in Australia has a history something like this, whether it's more or less fraught. And the shorebirds, because of my love of birds as well, and then it ties into you know, the environmental message, because they're the most endangered group of birds in Australia and New Zealand. So that's where the migratory shorebird theme started, as a sort of a mixed environment, real world thing about the birds themselves, but also as this rather grand metaphor for migration.
Have you got a new project coming up? Is there anything in the pipeline?
Something we prepared? Something I prepared earlier. I've just started a new project. I've done a couple of big projects about migratory shorebirds, and this new one is the biggest yet. It's called the Overwintering Project, Mapping Sanctuary, and I'm trying to get artists, printmakers from all over Australia and also New Zealand to contribute a print. I'm asking them to do a bit of homework. I'm asking them to find out where their local migratory shorebird habitat is, to go down there, see if they can find the birds, have a look around. Often these are unremarkable places, you know. They can be like sort of tail ends and backs of beaches and places that have been even reclaimed for docks and whatnot. But they are still very precious because these birds that travel thousands and thousands and thousands of miles come back to this place. They're very, very site faithful. So they tend to come back to the same place generation after generation. So it's also a bit about learning to love what's in your backyard. You might not think of it as special, you know, but it is. So I'm asking artists to make one print of about their local shorebird habitat and to send me, because you edition prints, so you can do as many prints as you can be bothered of any, most types of printmaking. So I'm asking them to send me two of the print that they make. One I'll sell to raise money for shorebird research, and the other, my plan is to build up like a mapping project, this sort of personal response to different areas of the coast, so which then can be exhibited, but then can be presented at the end to a museum or a gallery. Or
and how can people get involved or find out more information about this?
They can email me. It's overwinteringproject@gmail.com, or if you go to my website or my Facebook page, you can message me.
Okay.
Yeah.
Probably the best way to do it.
Yeah.
Again, thank you so much for your donation for the Joy Art Auction, and good luck with the future of and this project you're doing sounds absolutely wonderful.
Thank you. A really
lovely thing to do for our future, isn't it? It's really good.
Well, yeah, I hope so. Yeah. Thank you so much for having me.
You're very welcome. You're on Sunday Arts Magazine on Joy 94.9. Thank you to Kate Gorin-Smith.